Interview with Stan Willow, Friday, March the 16th, 2012. First, I would like to thank you for taking part in this program, and I would like to ask you if I have the permission to record this interview.
Yes, you have my permission.
Thank you. Could you give me a brief introduction about yourself and about your military career? When did you start it, and what determined you to joined the Canadian Forces?
Well, I joined the Army Reserve in 1974 and then went to Germany in 1976 as part of a flyover to the brigade that was there. And then when I came back, I decided to join the regular Army, so I joined in the December of 1976 and served as an infantry officer with Princess Patricia's Canadian Light Infantry until November of 1977. During that time, I did four UN tours in Cyprus in 1980, Western Sahara in 92. And then two tours in Bosnia and Croatia in 1994 and 95. They were back-to-back ones. I retired in 1997 as the rank of major, and then I transferred back to the Army Reserve here in Victoria. And I continued on for another 16 years, until I retired in May of 2011. I finally finished off as Lieutenant Colonel, and I also did one tour as a Reserve Lieutenant Colonel in my last UN tour in Sierra Leone in 2002. Why did I join the Army? Good question. I've always wondered about that, and I think I always liked the allure of doing something that was for good. I've got to leave it at that. I don't know what else.
When did you find out that you will be sent to Yugoslavia, and what was the reaction?
Well, it's funny, for United Nations missions, the only one I went through as told I was going and then had to go was in 1980 in Cyprus as part of the battalion, as the armed troops that were going. All of the other tours, they were as a military observer, and they're volunteer missions. They're officers only, and they sort of arrive as they're looking for nominations. And the more experience you have, it tends to be the more you go. So I was teaching at the battle school in Wainwright in 93. And then out came us questions where I was going to get posted in 94 after that. And then the option came up to go for a year to Yugoslavia, and I jumped at the chance because it was the spot to be at the time. And so I was a 30-something-year-old major, and, you know, if you're going to carry on in the Army, you need to have your field time. So I was quite keen on going. I was also living in Wainwright without my family, so the discussions about them and me going over was a little bit different, but we ended up getting it all sorted out, and off I went.
Were the objectives of the mission clear before you were?
Two-sided. You know, 94 was 2 years into the mission. In 93, we went into Bosnia, excuse me. So it's a Croatian mission rolled into a Bosnian mission. And there's lots of difficulty with the missions, too many mandates, too many different breaches, problems. We knew it was a very dangerous zone, so there was a level of excitement, a level of fear. But once you know you're going, that's when you start reading about it. And then I really started to focus in on where, you know, just 2 years before, I'd just come out of the Sahara, which was another process. So I was dumping one theater for now for another theater. So there was three tours in 2 years.
What could you tell me about the pre-deployment to
pre-deployment training?
Yes.
As a military observer, you don't belong to a unit, so we end up going to the Canadian Forces Peacekeeping Training Center in Kingston, Ontario, where this last time I went 2 years before, it was a week-long course. This time it was 3 weeks, and it was actually pretty comprehensive. Everything from weapons to resistance to interrogation or to hostage taking. We didn't worry about interrogation. You don't do that. Radios, communications, country information, language training, first aid training. Overall, it was pretty comprehensive, much better. Every time I went, the training was better, more focused, and more deliberate and more professional. So were we prepared? We were prepared in the book sense and the, yes, we're ready to understand where we're stepping into, but once we arrived in the theater, the rules changed, and it was a very different organization again.
How are the rules of engagement? Could you tell me a bit about that? if they were any different from the UN, from the regular Canadian Army.
Well, the rules of engagement under the UN Charter are very different than Canadian rules. There's Chapter 6 and Chapter 7 missions, for want of a better term, and Chapter 6 was this one. In fact, most missions until the turn of the last century and turn of the millennium, they were all Chapter 6, which basically meant you were prohibited from offensive action and prohibited from applying not even violence but force in order to achieve your objectives that were assigned to you. The difference post that, you know, after the Somali inquiry, after the Srebrenica massacre, after the Rwanda genocide, all of a sudden the UN started to be equipped with Chapter 7 missions, which meant they were able to use force in order to achieve the aims. Hence, when I was in Sierra Leone under Chapter 7, that was a successful mission because they walked away with achieving the aims. Bosnia and Croatia, the only reason those two ended under Chapter 6 was the Croats beat the heck out of their enclaves. And then NATO came in from the north across the Sava River in November of 95 to sort out the disengagement in Bosnia-Herzegovina. So Chapter 6s don't work. Not a big fan of UN ops anymore because they simply don't work. But you need to have the power to deal with warring factions that you can actually hit them when they disobey. And otherwise, the cost is 3,000 and 4,000 people, and Srebrenica is the Bosnian example of that.
So this rules of engagement were not entirely safe for a UN soldier?
Well, no, of course, they were very risky for a UN soldier. Now, there's two things as well. You have the UN rules of engagement, but you also have Canadian caveats that as a Canadian soldier, it doesn't matter where you go, you have the right to self-defense and protection. The only problem with a military observer is we're not armed, so you have very limited rights to self-protection. So most of it's used on the concept of being aware of where you are and making decisions where you're going to go or not go based on the threat. Otherwise, you can walk into something bad. And most of our deaths over there were either road traffic accidents for excessive speed in combat zones or getting shot at. So it was pretty tough.
Did you feel prepared when you arrived?
That's an interesting question. When you arrived in theater, you had another 5 days of training before you deployed anywhere. And so you had five more days in Zagreb where we went through in-country training, current briefs, sort of figured out where everything was going, what the enclave looked like or not, what the mission area looked like, Croatia, Bosnia, the two of them. And I remember one of the briefs they were talking about the enclaves and said, Garage, and I thought to myself, that's where I'm going to end up going. I'm sure as shooting, that's where I ended up going at first. So prophecy, I guess. But so you had that week, including some intensive language training, theater ops training, UN procedures protocol training, protection training in terms of where you should go, where you shouldn't go. We also were issued our equipment, flak jackets, helmets, that sort of thing from the Canadian contingent. Then we moved off. So I was going to Garajda, where I got posted in Zagreb. You get posted because that's the headquarters of the force and the military observer mission, which were two different things, so both of them. Then I rolled into Sarajevo, where I had another 7 to 10 days of acclimatization, where I got sent to a team site, and then I worked with them within the city of Sarajevo to start understanding patrolling routines, the team site operations, etc., before going to the enclave. And then about 5 or 6 days later, then we got the call, and once we had the clearance that they knew who was going in there, they had to get clearance through the Serbians, Bosnian Serbs. Then I went by convoy down into Garajda to start my 5 months there.
Could you please tell me about the camp? Oh, where was it situated? Where did you...
Which camp? All three of them, or...?
Sure.
Okay. Zagreb itself, the camp was the air base, really, right next to the air base, which was the main UN camp. We, as military observers, weren't entitled to live off the military land in terms of quarters or food, so we lived in hotels within the city, and then we would commute for that week into the headquarters. And that happened every time we flew out. We would arrive in Zagreb, go and check in at the Canadian contingent area for mail, debriefs, you know, steal a bit of food sort of thing, and then Canadian food, that is. And then off we'd go into the city and we'd live by ourselves. So I used to always go to the Olympia Hotel, was my favorite place, and right near the train station. Sarajevo itself was a bit different. The headquarters was in the PTT building in the western edge of the city. right near where the towers that I showed you about the newspaper building. And that was the headquarters of the Sarajevo garrison as well. At the time, was General Morion was the commander there. And then we had our own UN observer command as well. So we lived there, and then there was a variety of team outposts because the military observers work in team houses. They're out in Elitsha, for example, on the south side of the airfield. There was several in the north of town, about six team sites within Sarajevo itself. And these guys, their job was to manage the buffer zone around Sarajevo, monitor for heavy weapons, investigate shootings and all that sort of thing. So you lived in buildings, in apartments or rented houses, and then you worked out of the PT building. And at the same time, the later on when I got posted back to the Bosnia Command headquarters, it was in the presidency on the east edge of town, and that's where General Rose and the crew worked out of. And I was the chief operations officer there for the military observers. So we looked after all of Bosnia and the Austria, not peninsula, but the Austria portion of Croatia that we looked after just by virtue of was isolated by Sector East. So we had all of those. And that was on the way up to Tuzla, and I can't remember the name of the town. Zenica, I can't remember. Anyway, another little town. And then in Garajda, the team site there, we lived in a bank. We had the two floors of the bank, so the basement where the vault was our bunker and our eating area, then upstairs where the offices were for the bank, tellers, etc., and the management, that's where we lived. So I had a room in there, we had the op center there, we had a briefing area. And then on the top floor, there was 160 refugees living, and from where our building was on the second floor, the other side of it, a very small portion, was still, funny enough, an office or a bank building, but money wasn't a real concern there anymore, so it wasn't very busy.
How was your everyday life as a Canadian soldier?
Well, as a Canadian soldier, it was very different because I didn't work for Canada per se. You're in essence seconded to the UN, so the focus was, though you're a national soldier, you're working for the UN benefit and processes. So you worked for 30 days in a row within the team site with no holiday. So it was every day, Monday to Sunday, 24 hours a day. And then after 30 days, you're entitled to 5 days holiday. The problem was getting out of the pocket, either by having enough people on the team to continue working or by physically being able to get out of there based on route restrictions, etc. So my first month there turned into be just over 2.5 months before I had my first leave. So I was everyday work for 68 days or 70 days, and it was a long, long haul. It was busy. Garage to pocket was a very violent, very active, not violent, I was violent too, but a very active place. So, you know, I was shelled there, mortared, shot at, issues with the various checkpoints, casualties bringing in and out, lots of investigations of mortarings and shellings, went on and on. Very busy 2 months.
Could you please tell me in chronological orders the operations you were part in?
It's hard to do because we didn't do operations. Our job was monitoring. So the armed troops, they did operations. We just did the daily go out and see what's going on. So we were basically the reconnaissance force for the UN commander. Not even so much the in-place forces like the British battalion or the Ukrainian company that was there. We dealt with them daily, but we sort of synchronized what we did, but we were complementary but not working together. So we had our own areas where we went to, and the armed troops had a variety of checkpoints. So all the ground between the checkpoints was what the military observers looked at. So we had our own outpost in the east and the west and the north and a variety that in the south. But along the south, because it was such a high fire zone along the Drina River, most of the British checkpoints were there. So we used to just co-locate with them to find out what they see to corroborate. Because everything we had to do, if something was going wrong, you needed a double set of verification. So if the Brit battalion saw something or the Ukrainians, they'd call us, we'd send a patrol out, and we'd try and confirm what action that they were reporting so that there was always the force report and then what we used to call UNMO confirmed, which was the military observers corroborating the evidence so that you were able to actually take this stuff to the Security Council or at the national level discussions. There were several cases where we had incidents in Garajda that ended up direct. My reports would go direct to Zagreb, and then from there immediately to the UN Security Council. But it's just a process of getting information quickly to try and get a decision on what's going on. So no operations, but you know, 365 days minus the 40 days of holiday, where every day you'd go out and drive around and try and find out what's going on and stick your head where most people didn't want you.
So could we could develop more on what were the objectives after you deployed? What was your objective as
the UN mission in Bosnia Herzegovina was a humanitarian mission by UN mandate, which is unfortunate because it was a carryover from the Croatian one, and there wasn't enough time to get a new one voted in. And this was that, if you think about 92, when everybody went into Sarajevo to try and stop the bloodbath that was going in there. The problem we had in Bosnia was there was an excess of violence. We had lots of troops in neighboring countries. We just had to figure out how to get them in there now. And so the process became humanitarian mission to assist in relief to the population. And then we went in with, 40,000, 50,000 troops? 30,000 troops, I think it was. But anyway, so that was the mission. However, our tasks were much beyond that. It was verification of weapons, monitoring of exclusion zones, investigation of shootings and shellings, especially within the four enclaves of Zepa, Srebrenica, Garajda, and Sarajevo. Those four areas all had 20-kilometer exclusion zones where there were supposed to be heavy weapons. So every time something big went bang, you had to go find out what it was. And so we'd spend a lot of time digging shrapnel out of trees or pulling fuses from shells out of the dirt to try and determine where they came from and who. So it's relatively easy when with mortars and artillery to find out the direction of flight based on the hole in the ground they make. So we used to do those little crater analyses to figure out where the stuff came from. And they would subsequently become protests at various levels, to either local or national or international protests to the warring factions based on their breaking the rules of the ceasefire. Because all missions are supposedly agreed to by both sides, both combatants, to allow the UN in. The difficulty we had, though, was every time we tried to stop something of combat-wise, be it snipers, be it maneuvers, be it taking villages, terrain allocation changes, all of that stuff, they used to, both sides would throw back to us, depending on which was convenient, that it was a humanitarian mission and we didn't have the rights to do that. The funny thing is we had, up until about the fall of 94, November, December of 1994, the Muslims were the one that were using us basically as shields. Then they were equipped, re-equipped, retrained, rearmed, uniforms were consistent, and then they started to attack and push back at the Serbs, and then the Serbs all of a sudden turned around and started to be the ones asking for our help in order to identify what was going on. So you ended up having a little bit of a shoe on a different foot at the end of 94 into 95. And then it stabilized again when both sides got mean and started shooting each other seriously for a while. So no missions, no operations, just a whole bunch of stuff. So, but you really have three phases in the 94-95 time frame, which was the end of the war. It was the 94 to December of 94, which was the re-establishment of the Muslim military capability after being hammered in 93. They retrained, rearmed, re-equipped. Then you had the January 95 to about July of 95, which was the pressure from both sides, which created the ability for the ceasefire and the peace accord to be signed in the late summer of 95. And then you have the July-August time frame in 95, which was the Srebrenica massacre in August of 95, that turned public opinion completely against the whole process, which has been going on now for 6 years. And that was a real catalyst for the final signing of the British-based peace accord, which then finally caused Operation Storm with a Croatian attack into sectors north, south, east, and west, which were the Serbian-Croat positions along the border. They wiped all of those out in about 7 days, and that ended their war, and then the UN, the NATO came in and solved the occupied the Bosnian side once they crossed the Sava River, and then by December, I think it was, then they went in as I-4 and subsequently S-4 for separation forces, and they're still there. Sorry, there's the nutshell of my year in Bosnia, Croatia.
So you mentioned you were fired upon?
Yes, several times.
Could you please tell me more about that and the experience?
It's a focusing event. Most of the times, Well, that's not fair. A lot of the times we're in garage to the first 5 months. Very active zone, very very vicious Serbs in the area. The Foča Brigade. Can't remember the name of the major in command. I'm convinced he's a certified lunatic, but he was an extremely aggressive man, including to a point where he threatened to kill our liaison officer in just outside of Garajda. We ended up defusing that one as well, but mortared on top of a hill in the northern edge of town where we were investigating a shelling, standing out in the open watching the Serbs run around their weaponry. So we moved back into the woods, at least I did, and myself and a Polish officer. So we're sitting on the side of a hill on a tree stump. When the first mortar went off, you could hear it sort of punk in the distance. And it hadn't been mortared before for real, so I didn't sort of recognize what the sound was until it went boom behind me, about 10, 15 feet behind my back. And all the shrapnel, luckily, was on a steep hill, went over our heads. So we dove into a trench. Another round came in, and all of a sudden the punk meant something, which was the launch of the mortar from a couple Ks away. So every 3 or 4 minutes, they'd drop another one in. So once you heard the punk, you had about 30 seconds before it landed. And that's when we decided as a group, there were four of us at the time, that we were leaving. So off we went back up the forward slope where the Serbs were seeing us and shooting at us, then down over the other side. So another 14, 15 rounds were fired at us on the way out. And then when we got to the bottom of the hill where we left, it was foggy. And coming back now, the heavy machine guns down the valley started shooting as we were crossing the open area, which was another teaches to run fast. So anyway, so we got across in a staggered formation across there with nobody hurt. Drove back, and that was the break. Had a bit of beer and got ready for the next day. And other occasions, we were with a Danish or Dutch captain, a tanker, a nice guy. We were in along the Drina River in the south end at an OP in an old building up on a hill about 800 meters from the river. And we were standing there, and then somebody started shooting at us from the Serbian side of the river. So the first round hit the wall we were behind, and then the rest all around us. So we ducked down and waited for it to slow down. Unfortunately, he wasn't. So we ended up having to... We played rock, paper, and scissors to figure out who was going to go where the car was to get our helmets, flak jackets, and radio in for support. So again, we're not armed, so, you know, what do you do? So I lost the toss, and I had to go run into the car. We thought it was one type of weapon. It was something else with a bigger magazine, so we learned that one the hard way. And then called in for the Brits, called in for support from our guys, and then the Brits came on the air because they monitored our frequency. They offered they had a machine gun team and another sniper unit just up from us, so they called them in to provide support. The military observers, they got the armored Suburban, we had an armored car with us, they got that fired up to come down to provide physical protection. We came onto the main road, and so we put on our flak jackets and helmets, threw the stuff on the back of the truck, and took off. And we turned a corner, and the guy started really shooting in earnest, and I remember sitting in the car behind a copse of trees, and the leaves are falling on the car like snow almost, and I'm looking at the Dutch guy, and he's taking his flak jacket off. And I asked him what the hell he's doing, and he said he wanted to give me the jacket with plates because I was on the shooter's side. So we put it between the car frame and my body as we kept driving. And then we finally drove out of the way, and on the way out I gave the order to the Brits to start shooting at the target indication I gave them. And they ended up blasting the house that we'd figured out they were coming from, the fire was coming from. And then hit the main road, linked up with the armored car, and we drove inboard. They were outboard, and we drove back. And then the next morning on the Serbian news, my interpreter told us that they'd reported that a guy was injured in the village, the little hamlet that we'd ended up firing at. So we got the guy, but he didn't get killed, but he got wounded. So that was that one. Later on, I got shelled in Dubrovnik, which was an odd one because I very rarely got shelled, but at the Dubrovnik airport. So including where they hit the fueling station, put a big burst of fire, etc. And then when that fire went out, when we reported it, we were directed not to go searching for stuff, digging it. Weird rules down in that part of the world. So I'm not too keen on how the sector commander at the time there was limiting our ability to investigate. So I, what the hell, and I carried on digging. So I found out where the round came from based on the trajectory hole of the fuse, which digs into the ground a couple feet, so you can almost put a stick in the hole and it'll tell you the direction it came from. And then we dug out the rest of it in pieces, figured out it was a 76 millimeter light cannon round. So a bunch of those had hit, including a small hamlet of four or five houses. Luckily nobody was hurt, but 16 shells were landed by our count, more than that by the local police, but we only report what we heard. And then that caused a great deal of constraint, and I ended up being relieved of the command of the I was the deputy team leader in the southern team site on the Austria Peninsula. I ended up working as the MIO for the sector in Dubrovnik for my last couple months for that little bit of stuff. So I guess they had to get the irritant guy out into the headquarters. But it worked out well. Then a Russian came in after this, and he was a bit more pragmatic, but still very very political down in that southern corner. A lot of issues with prisoners. They would capture various people, put them in jail. So, you know, fishermen from Montenegro or Albania. So we'd try and sort them out. Prisons were horrible there. Didn't like going to them. And we had in one case where we had a Royal Marine had to take a fishing boat back down into Montenegro. So he jumped in and drove it around the peninsula. Gave it back to the locals after we'd secured the release of the fishermen, but they wouldn't let him drive through. So I didn't have much of time. The only thing that didn't happen to me, I got rocketed in Donyavakuf, which was interesting. We were in an OP, and all of a sudden the BM-21s started coming in, and very loud, very noisy when they go bang. But luckily for us, they were a little bit down the hill, not directly at us, so it was close, but it was not close, but close enough. No tanks, though, luckily. Nobody shot at me with a tank. Sarajevo was tough, though. They were odd, random shots all the time. Not a good place to be.
Could you please tell me about the information about Ratko Mladic and your encounter with him?
Ratko Mladic was the commander of the Serbian army, so he was the head of the armed forces for the Bosnian Serbs. A little short guy. Very very tough. He ended up to be the number two war criminal after Karadzic. And then when Karadzic was captured, he was elevated to number one. And he was just captured, I think, 2 years ago. Well, in the fall of 94, I think it was September, we were coming back out of Sarajevo going into Garajda. And one of the checkpoints, one of the innumerable checkpoints we had to go through was a place called Rogatica on the way between Sarajevo and Garajda. So we used to go through there quite often, and you'd have our constant arguments with the troops there because they're not supposed to search us. But if you don't let them search your stuff, you can be there conceivably for days, which happened to a British column once. They were stuck there for 3 days, and that escalated very interestingly. But anyway, so we used to let them inspect our baggage, but never ourselves. So our flak jackets, our helmets, our uniforms that we wore, they weren't allowed to touch, but they could go with the other stuff. So if you common sense, you didn't put anything in there. Well, we were coming back with two vehicles from my team site in Garajda and one vehicle from Zeppa, if I think. Yeah, Zeppa, French guy, traveling on his own. So we used to go in convoys together to reduce risk. Anyway, so the Serbs, they found a letter to the Muslim commander in Garajda, a guy named Bula Bastić. They found a letter in a small parcel in the baggage of one of the officers. So rule number one, they broke that. Rule number two, it's too late, we're stuck. So we were all arrested and getting ready to be incarcerated somewhere in the local jail. And then a green Land Rover, Land Cruiser came up, and out popped the two guards and this little short guy. And my interpreter, a 17, 18-year-old girl, got really excited about who was coming out, and she told me it was Ratko Mladic. And so I told her to interpret exactly what I said, because normally they'll change things to make it more palatable to whoever they're talking to. So she agreed, so it was hopefully a direct translation. So he came up and he wanted to know what was going on, because we had three white cars there, a bunch of guys and a whole bucket of guys with guns that were on the other side. So the local guards started explaining to him what was going on. He came to us, and so we had my interpreter, and he didn't have one, so through her, he said, "Who's in charge?" And I said, "I was." And he said, "Right, what's going on?" And told him, and he says, "You know, we can throw you in jail and cut your head off for that." And I said, "Well, you can throw me in jail, but you probably don't want to cut our heads off." And he sort of laughed at that and carried through. And while we're talking, the guards are opening up the letter and showed him the letter. He was served with Bula Bastić in the JNA in the army, so they knew each other. And then the parcel was a couple pairs of socks, you know, Disney socks for a little girl, and some, patent medicine sort of stuff. So, funny enough, he said, "Right, well, I can go to Bula Bastić, give him my regards." And he said, "You're all free to go." And then they pulled a camera out of my interpreter's purse, and he looked around and said, "Whose camera?" And she said, "Well, it's mine." And this she all told me in the car on the way afterwards. And they said, "Are you a good Serb?" And she says, "Well, I'm a Serb." And I remember watching his smile drop, and he said, "Not good enough." He says, "I'm a good Serb." He says, "Fine." He smiled, gave her the camera back. And then he said, "Right, let's have a picture." So, son of a gun. So we ended up, we all lined up with the two guards on one side, Mladic in the middle, my interpreter and the Ukrainian guy in the front, the Irishman and myself, the Spaniard and the Frenchman, all standing sort of in the back, and one of the other guards took the picture, so I have this picture, but it's in somebody else's camera. None of us had cameras because of the difficulty of getting through the checkpoints. This was before digital, so it was all photograph, you know, all, what do you call it, film. So anyway, so on the way back, he let us go, and we're driving away, and he'd gone north, we were going south, and the interpreter was telling me what's going on. We're having a couple cigarettes, a cigar, relaxing, hit two more checkpoints. Then finally, before we hit the Serb liaison post where we dropped the Serbian interpreter off, then, you know, we have our own inside, I asked her if she'd send me a picture. She said, of course. So that's the last I saw of her for several months until I was in Sarajevo, and then I got to Sarajevo in the end of November. And then in January, one of the patrolmen, they brought in an envelope for me, and it had a copy of the picture for me. So she'd sent me finally the copy of that picture. So I have that sitting in my wall somewhere. That's my claim to fame with Ratko Mladic.
You mentioned Sarajevo. Could you please develop more on that? What was the problem in Sarajevo? What was the conflict, and what was your objective?
The problem with Sarajevo depended on which side you were on. For the Muslims, they had Serbs in it, and for the Serbs, they had Muslims in it. That was sort of the problem. But Sarajevo was the capital city of Bosnia. Beautiful, beautiful city. But it went through some pretty tough times. So you ended up with two quarters, or three quarters and one quarter, sort of. Three quarters Muslim and less than a quarter Serbian-held territory, and then a whole bunch of no-man's land in between. So on the north-central side of the city was basically a small enclave of Serbs, which they battled in constantly. It was sort of like a mini Stalingrad sometimes. And then you had a no-man's land, and then you had the airport where the UN was, and then you had more Muslims and more Serbs on the other side. So the Serbians wanted to maintain the stranglehold on Sarajevo. The Muslims obviously wanted to keep it. But the interesting things within the area was, one was the tunnel, which they never acknowledged until post-war, which we used to drive by all the time because it was on the way to one of our team houses. And plus, the person I lived with when I worked in the headquarters, I rented a room from a family, myself and another officer, two of us, and one had the two bedrooms. They lived in two other rooms. I lived in a six-story or seven-story apartment building. So the poor dad, every once in a while, would be called away for 30 days worth of labor battalion work. And so he'd be stringing wire up hills as a labor guy, or porting, acting as a porter to bring materials through the tunnel, which went between Alica and Grebovica, the two suburbs on each side of the airport. So that's, give the guy enough vodka and he'll tell you all sorts of things, the poor bugger. But he used to come back so tired, it was almost unfair to try and, you know, find information out for him. But we talk to everybody all the time to find out what's what. The other parts of Sarajevo that were odd, you'd be in a neighborhood and there'd be house, and then an empty shell of a house or just an empty field, and that used to be the other side. So if you're in a Muslim neighborhood, that would have been a Serb house. So they completely destroyed them, eradicated it, so people wouldn't come back. The rest of the place, it was, especially in 94, lots of shootings. You had the tram shooting in August. Unfortunately, we're pretty sure that the shooting was from the Muslim side out. We had the two market mortarings. I'm pretty sure one of them was a Muslim mortaring. A lot of argument over that. But some of us think both of them were Muslim mortarings. The interesting thing about the Muslims, though, within Sarajevo, especially when they're nearing the 1,000-day mark of the siege, they had an irrational desire to supersede the siege of Leningrad time of 1,000 days. So I remember it was in, if I remember, January of 95, was when they crossed the 1,000-day mark. In order to celebrate, they turned on all of the power, the water, and the gas in the city for 3 days for everybody, where before that and after 3 days, you only got one of the three of them a day. If you were lucky, and really lucky, you would end up two of them for a day, so water and gas, or electricity and water, or some such, in order to make life work a bit. But they turned everything on for 3 days. So it was very much a political battle for the world media as well. I remember times you'd watch the, you sure learned to dislike the media there. But they would set up their cameras and all of a sudden people would start coming around, and if they were filming a bloody spot or even a casualty, the wailing would start, you know, the hair pulling, the wailing women and everything else. The moment they turned the camera and walked away, but it got up and walked away. They had no care at all what was going on. But for the media, it was a great show. It was very odd to watch. Very cynical looking. But, you know, they were a cynical people, and I can't blame them. They were living very, very hard, very, very tough, cold, minimum amounts of food, very, very tough police force in terms of military police, huge demands on all able-bodied males to work, lots of shooting. And the rotten thing was the Serbs would spend more time shooting women and old men than they would in kids, than they would the soldiers. You know, throughout the Bosnian War, you'd hear of three-day battles in the Brguli finger, the sap in the thumb, you name it. But you'd end up with casualty rates of 2 and 3, where we'd have 2 and 3 casualties a day in Sarajevo when there were kids and women. So a very different argument. We had to go and see the commander of the Ilyich Brigade to try and work out a ceasefire in September, a local ceasefire, our interest with the military observers. So we went to talk to this guy, and he supposedly is the one who did the shooting of the vice president in 92 in the back of the French APC. And he just simply looked at us with cold, sort of dead eyes and said, you know, every time they shoot one of my soldiers, I'm going to kill 10 of them. And that was the rule. And so he kicked his unceremoniously out of his office, and that was our attempt to broker a local ceasefire in the western part of Sarajevo. The rest of the time we spent in Sarajevo, or at least the teams, they were out there observing what was going on and reporting. You know, we'd have up to 3,000 shooting incidents a day, and that's one round to a 15-minute firefight was an incident. But it was a very busy little combat zone. And then when I worked in the headquarters, I was the chief operations officer, so my job was to compile all the reports from each of the sectors. So you had Garage, you had Sector South, Sector East, Sector North, you had the Behatch Pocket, you had the Austria Thumb, I think we called it, if I remember, which was Croatian but still part of the Bosnian side command. And then I would send my daily reports off to both New York and the headquarters in Zagreb. So that was the compilation every night. And then over Christmas of 94, that's when Jimmy Carter came in and brokered the ceasefire, the local ceasefire. I wasn't there, actually. I was on home and leave. But I remember coming back and arriving in Sarajevo, and there were 15 shooting incidents a day, and we were standing around looking at each other wondering what the hell we were going to do because it was so quiet. And then Orthodox Christmas came up. They started shooting again, and then back to normal. So we were busy again. So I stayed there until the end of February. So end of November to the end of February, that was my 7 months in Bosnia. Then I was posted into the Dubrovnik sector as my my quiet period, supposedly.
If you would see someone shooting at civilians, or if you would assist a sniper shooting at a civilian, would you be allowed to fire in that direction, or the rules of engagement restricted?
Well, a couple problems. Number one, as a military observer, I don't have a weapon, so I can't shoot. However, the armed forces, they had a variety of tools to try and limit it, but you had to actually receive direct fire at you in order to shoot back. And that was one of the problems, is you couldn't respond to protect human life, which is the difference with the Chapter 7 operation. So we would sort of bend the rules a bit. And I remember for a while in Sarajevo, we ended up with either a Russian or a French armored car along the main street. Almost every junction was an armored car there, but you had to, the rules said you could have the car there, but you couldn't aim the main weapon, the primary gun, at anything. So it used to point up in the air and be, you know, down the street as opposed to facing where the risk was coming from. So some interesting rules. So yes, there were sort of things we could do, but no, there were a lot of things we couldn't do. A couple times I'd sort of broke the rules where we never were supposed to take passengers, but I would stop, and I remember in Garage Day again, there were a bunch of kids were getting shot at. And I was coming by in the armored car myself. We were short staff, so I had to go and check a report of something. Anyway, so there were these kids. So I drove past them and watched them all huddling behind the traffic guardrail. And I said, no, this is dumb. So I turned the car around, stopped, put them all in the armored Suburban, and then kept driving. And this little kid kept rubbing the back of my head saying, Danke schön, thank you, in German. And then on the way, taking them back to Bari where they lived, I think it was Bari, there was a wheelbarrow in the middle of the road. There's no traffic on this road, mainly just us, but there was a wheelbarrow with an old lady laying in it. And I thought, oh crap, she's dead. So I stopped the car and went to look at her. She'd just given up. They were shooting, so she laid in her wheelbarrow to wait it out, I guess. So I put her in the back of my car, left the wheelbarrow there, drove her along, and took them all into the town and dropped them off. And that was sort of broke the rules, but I didn't have the heart to leave those kids, you know, 5 Ks from home with bugger shooting at them again for nothing better to do. Afternoons are bad because the drinking started, so then they had very little control. The Serbian army, You had the corps, they would have one set of rules, the brigades would have another set of rules, the battalions would have another set of rules, the companies would have another set, the patrols would, depending on the commanders. So you never knew what the terms of reference were you were dealing with. So it made it sometimes very tough to negotiate, because you had to know the people. And that Fortula Brigade, Major Fortula was his name, that's the guy in the garage, that he was just a loose cannon. We used to plan to get to Sarajevo, we'd have to leave 4 hours early to factor in the 2 or 3 hours he'd make us wait at his checkpoint, just because we were there. So we'd sit there and wait and smoke and read, and until finally he'd lift the gate, or have the troops lift the gate, and we'd drive away. He never wanted to talk to us, funny enough, but mad bugger. I'm not sure what happened to him. And we had other issues with General Rose, with his Serbian spy, Captain Stanley, who was in there for a while. Odd-looking chap, very swarthy, looked Serbian, funny enough, but turned out to be a Serb, and he ended up going to jail in England for, I think treason was the funny term they used, but General Rose could never understand why his convoy, when he was going various places, would end up with hitting a cow or having some sort of delay to his travels all the time, because he used to range far and wide all the time, but very odd. He even flew into our place once in Garage, him and his wife, of all things, and they gave the hospital an incubator, so they... Doctors were very appreciative. He flew away, and they took the incubator, put dirt in it, and started growing tobacco in it. No power, no electricity, so what are you going to do with an incubator? So, anyway, I got a call. He was coming back to check out his incubator, so I had to spend an hour dealing with the doctors, convincing them to clean it out so it looked like they were using it. They did it, and, they know where their bread is buttered, and off they went. But the hospital was tough. There was no anesthetic, just the smell was horrendous. Inside that building, but you got to give the doctors credit for what they did with nothing. But we had old rubber tubing, looks like World War II, with pop bottles that were draining shot lungs, and it was tough. Medicine Frontier was in Garage. They went on strike for a month, didn't do anything. That was pretty tough to watch. So it changed my opinion of MSF dramatically. MSF. So we used to drive up into the hinterland and try and help in the field hospitals, deliver stuff and give assessments of what's going on, figure out who's been shot, how many, that sort of thing. But MSF, they never left the town, as far as I know, at least the 5 months I was there. Red Cross wouldn't talk to us, another interesting bit. We're trying to do the same grand job. We're looking for 3 prisoners that weren't recorded. One was a nephew of a Serb general or something. And we thought we knew where they were, but we weren't even allowed into the Red Cross building because our troops, no guns. Well, we don't carry guns, but still. So you'd have very antagonistic discussions with a German or a Dutch lady or something in the front step, and they wouldn't listen to your talk, so off you went and did our own stuff. Garage was nice because there were 3 Canadians there. There was a RCMP Sergeant Terry, I can't remember his last name, but great guy. And then there was a public a civil affairs officer, and I wish I could remember his name, another very smart man, but the 3 Canadians. And so we all lived in different places within the city, but every couple of days we'd get together at either my office or the police office to talk about what are we going to do to try and stabilize the town. We're slightly different way of looking at it as the Canadians than the Brits, say, or the Ukrainians, or even the UN. So we would try and broker between the 3 of us, a civil policing side, military observation and response, and civil affairs, trying to rebuild government to some extent, to try and get that working. And I don't think it worked very well, but at least it was a noble effort by a bunch of optimistic Canadians, I guess. But I still communicate with Terry, the policeman, once in a while. He's now working in The Hague for years, but I should remember his last name, but I don't know. Yeah, very nice guy.
Could you also tell me about the mines in this area and the UN attempt to demine all the zones? Who would actually put the mines, and what were their purpose?
All sides put the mines out, except the blue guys in blue, as far as I know. I wouldn't be surprised if the Russians didn't do something, but generally both the Croats and the Serbs, Muslims, doesn't matter, all of them did it. They laid out their own mines. The UN didn't, and we wouldn't clear mines. The UN wouldn't clear mines unless they were a direct threat to the UN. Either you were stuck in a minefield or, I can't figure that one, I'll tell you a story about that in a minute, but basically they used mines, one as a deterrent based on, the normal reasons there, to deny routes, canalize troops, all the rest of that stuff, but also they used the threat of mines as a way to limit freedom of movement, which was probably the most important thing for us as military observers, was constantly hammering at all sides to give us freedom of movement so we could do our job. So they'd say there's mines there, and all right, no. But the risk is if they tell you there's mines there and you don't believe them, the way of finding out tends to be very final. So we were forced to trust them when we said it. The corollary, of course, is after the war was over and I finally saw one of the national minefield maps of the country and all the red in there, there were an awful lot of mines. But we had one case in Dubrovnik. I was down on the Austria Peninsula, very bottom end of Croatia by the Bay of Kotor. And the Croats, the Croat army, they laid 17 PMR-2s right outside our front gate. So those are the pineapple and a stick Russian hand grenades that they had a tripwire on. So if I remember, there were 14 of them at various places. And this was in February. So I reported it. It was February, beginning of March. I reported it in and they said, are they affecting your freedom of movement? Well, not right now, as long as we stay away from them. So we marked them so our guys knew and nobody else came, so we were okay. But then as the grass started to grow, I was watching the taller and taller grass push in the wind, because we're on the coast, it's always windy, pushing against the tripwires, and I'm watching the pins slowly move in these bloody hand grenades. So that started to become unsafe. So still, the UN wouldn't send any mine-clearing teams down. We used to find on the Austro Peninsula a bunch of anti-landing mines that the Croats would come through the old Austro-Hungarian gun positions, a bunch of tunnels on the south side. They would come through at night, lay these big mines, so every 3 or 4 months I'd report one or two, every 2 months, report a couple, and they'd send down some combat engineers to take them away. So we got fed up with this one day, and so we said, right, send us a platoon of engineers, and we'll fill the bunker positions with barbed wire. So they sent a platoon of Ukrainian combat engineers down, and we filled all of the gun positions on both sides with concertina, you know, the coiled barbed wire, so that troops couldn't get in and out. So we solved that problem, and then to pay them back, I sort of hosted a dinner for them, so a bunch of food, you know, barbecue, that sort of thing, a bunch of beer and wine and stuff. And I was talking to the young sergeant in charge, and I was telling him about my minefield problem, and he looked at me and smiled and said, I'll be back, and off he went with a beer, and he came back 30 minutes later and said, right, your problem solved. He'd put safety pins into all the fuses, so he disarmed all of the mines. So that became the problem no more, and we ignored, stopped worrying about it. But we also, during the spring there, we had a problem with we'd put a couple of halogen lights at the entrance to the camp, and we actually put a fence across the very narrow isthmus there to reduce the access that the Croats were doing. Because we had an ongoing argument between the bunkers they were building, which were illegal, along the peninsula north of us, to where we were, because it was supposed to be a demilitarized zone. So we had constant arguments with them, and the Montenegrins and the Serbs, obviously, were always arguing about this militarization of the area. So they ignored us, but they kept trying to tick us off. So they used to shoot our halogen lights out. So we spent a month at night in our cars, patrol sitting out there at night trying to see what was going on. God knows why, but we did it for a month. I never found anything, but we kept replacing these shot-out lights. So there's always somewhere the solution was always a bullet. And then the claiming, we had several shelling incidents there, mainly because the three borders all meet down in that southern corner there, down in here. And we had three team sites, one in Montenegro and Herceg Novi. We had one up in the corner of Croatia, butted against the Serbian border and the Montenegrin border, and then us in the Austro Peninsula. And they used to shell on a monthly basis. And anyway, the big moment of fame was that one in the airport, where at least we were able to acknowledge that it was coming from the Serb territory as opposed to anywhere else. Anyway, there's that. Interesting place.
What about the city with the bridge that was blown off? You told me, was it Mostar?
Oh, Mostar, yeah. Mostar was an interesting town. The Mostar in 93-94 was very contested for quite some time, and it was mainly a small arms battle. And there's they did significant damage to some parts of the city with the small arms, but they also destroyed that beautiful bridge. I can't remember the name of it, but the big high-arched bridge. They replaced it with a footbridge, and for a while it was covered with a variety of corrugated iron and wood, and so you'd sort of run in underneath that bridge and they'd take pot shots at you, not knowing where you are, so get a little ventilation in your bridge. And then that stuff was taken off later on. Once the UN had come in, the Spanish battalion was there, and there was two UN posts or military observer posts, and basically started to calm down. So later on in 95, they replaced the bridge with the Bailey Bridge, which was a big one, and then post-war they actually rebuilt the bridge. But Mostar also was the place where the economic European community brought in their policemen. So several hundred, I think they were Germans mainly, came into Mostar to try and stabilize the town. It seemed to work. It was a pretty violent place for a while, but relatively calm after that. Then you had the place like Prozor, which was a Wild West town. Prozor was Croatian for window, or Bosnian for window. But anyway, it was so bad the British garrison had to put 3 armored cars in the entrance, one on each entrance to the village, and one in the middle, so that when you drove through it on the way up to Tomislavgrad, you would have to report in at the first car on one side or the other you're going into, stop at the middle car, tell them you're still there, and then go to the third one, because they were hijacking cars all the time. We had actually in the latter part of spring, winter of 95, January, February, March, we were losing almost a car a week, 2 cars a week to hijackings, where they'd pull up a bunch of guns and you'd get out of the car and they'd drive away in it, and you're short a car. I remember one we found, it was less than 24 hours later, and our UN car was painted red. But you could tell it was still UN because the radio mount was in the back and the inside was still white. And on an angle, you could still see the UN, the black marking on the door of the car through the red paint. So they were very quick and efficient in stealing our stuff. Had another case with the poor old British battalion in Gornji Vukov, which was the sector headquarters for BritBat, and the BritBats had that sector. Muslim commander drove in a formerly a UN observer car. They closed the gate and said, no, you have to give our car back. He said, no, you don't understand. It's my car now. And they said, no, it's our car. Give it back. It's UN property. So the next thing we knew, he had a little radio call, and then there was a platoon and a half of Muslims outside our entrance, and now you couldn't get in or out of the sector headquarters. So they had to give up and give him his car, and he drove away, and he never came back in it, but he had one of our cars. So when you saw those nice new Toyota Land Rovers and Land Cruisers going around, you knew they were our cars. Interesting bunch of people. And you still had tourists coming in there, even in the height of the height of the fighting in Mostar. They would come over to the hill looking down, and that picture I showed you down in the town of Mostar, take a right turn and go to Medjugorje to go see where the Virgin Mary was in that village. And it was very odd watching that go on. But these buses would go across the pontoon bridge in the Nevarita River. And anyway, very, very odd place. Everything's different. Split was a Wild West town. I cut a guy off in a car there. I was doing a U-turn on the road. Shouldn't have done it, but what the hell. And then he pulled up next to me and pulled out the biggest handgun I ever saw and pointed at me. So I let him go ahead. So he drove away quite happy. So I cleaned up my driving a bit there. You get very offensive in your driving when there's no rules and you're too slow or something else and they can shoot at you. You tend to drive fast and erratic. So when you go to a place that's not as violent as Sarajevo or Mostar or Garajda, and then you go to the city, it's a little bit different. We're very bad drivers in Zagreb. You wonder sometimes why we had so many car accidents. But cars are badly maintained, high speeds for safety and protection. Bad tires. The maintenance system was horrible. We didn't have enough tires in Sarajevo for a while, for example. We ran out of fuel during the siege. Part of it, we had only enough to investigate active patrols, the MOs, the armed troops, only the reaction platoons had fuel. And they shut down our operations for almost a month because we didn't have enough gas or diesel to do the operations.
Were you or any of your comrades wounded during?
Well, we had one of them in the spring of 95. You remember where the Serbs took them all and handcuffed them to everything. Pat Reckner was one of our NMOs. He was the liaison officer in Pale. He was captured and spent a couple days handcuffed to a lamppost on a bridge, but they did that for about 3 weeks. Funny enough, they were doing it for months before in Banja Luka at the airport, but they had there was an airstrike in the fall of 94 into a Croatian-Serbian-Croat airfield, and then after that, the Serbs put the UNMOs on the Banja Luka airstrip every day, chained to their chairs during daylight hours, and they did that for almost 6 months. It was always interesting at the headquarters when they asked for volunteers to go to Banja Luka, because you knew where you were going to be. But we lost... In Garajda, in a week, we lost 7 Brits, dead, 5 wounded from 2 rollovers, a new battalion coming from the Gloucester, Berkshire, Wiltshires. Very, very sad that that was tough. I lost a good friend of mine, was killed by another UNMO in February of 95. He was coming back from Garajda back to Sarajevo, and the Nigerian officer beat him half to death with a tire iron, threw him over the escarpment onto the... hopefully into the river, I guess, but he ended up in a tree, and he ended up freezing to death and dying from his injuries and hypothermia by the time they finally found him. It was only 2 days after I left. He's a good friend of mine. It's very sad, but And we lost another couple here and there, but no Canadians, luckily, at least. We did go, and one of the guys on the tour, he was shot a year before with a 50, of all things, 50 caliber into his leg. Very lucky that it was a ricochet, but it would have taken his leg off. But he was wounded, his interpreter was killed, and I was still surprised we sent him back. He had some issues. But a good guy, good artillery officer, hardworking man.
How was your relation with the civilians, with the local ethnics?
The ethnics, yeah. It's difficult because each area is different. In the enclaves, Garage de Sarajevo, it was very hard. It was hard because you had more than they did, and they're very proud people, both sides, I have to be honest. But they necessity breeds a change in how you work. They say Maslow's needs, you never go down the ladder, but sure as he'll tell you they go down that ladder in that country. I think all countries they do. I don't believe that. It's more of a ERB theory where, you know, you rotate based on conditions as to how you are. But in the enclaves, they're very tough. I was ended up in a honey trap once, which didn't work, luckily. They wanted to blackmail me into providing prohibited goods to them, and luckily that didn't work. So generally, you stayed away from the locals. The interpreters you were close with, and you tried to help out, but that's because they were sharing the same risks you did. And sometimes they were your only advisory to risks. Sarajevo, the people we rented where we lived from and the people that worked for us, because we tried to spread the largesse out, we'd pay quite handsomely for people to do cleaning for us, feed us, that sort of thing, just because it's the only other thing to do. We ate as much as we could as well, because, you know, every little penny hurts or helps somewhere out there in the economy. I remember having horrible pizzas with... You just ordered a pizza, you never knew what was on it, but it would come out and you'd have this little chunk of meat with, or a chunk of bread with something on it, but, you know, you ate.
Were the interpreters targeted by the army for helping you?
Well, interpreters you had to be careful with, because we worked both sides, you had an interpreter for each side. Mm-hmm. So the Serbian wouldn't be with the Muslims, and the Muslims wouldn't be on the Serb side, that sort of thing. So, but they were always worried, and they were always very careful when they were dealing with in no man's land, when we would try and broker things, you'd have both interpreters there, and they'd be very careful. But I remember, funny, we had one interpreter in Sarajevo, a Serb, and I ran into him in the middle of the PTT, which is our headquarters in the middle of the Muslim land, and there's the Serbian interpreter. Go figure. I never got a suitable answer why he was in the middle there. So there was lots and lots and lots of stuff that went on between the factions that they didn't want us to know about or cared about. We did one in Grozny, for example. We were doing a body exchange negotiation for casualties, and we'd set up the checkpoint, set up the meeting site in no man's land between the two front lines. We'd provided a tent, a platoon worth of security, all of that stuff, and the both sides arrived, and they started talking, and they looked at us, and they said, "Go away." So we had to leave the guys in the blue hats, and they left the Serb and the Muslim commanders talking to each other for about half an hour before they invited us back into the area to now discuss. So obviously what they did was sorted themselves out and then came in to do the bullshit negotiation with us there. So they did their own negotiation. Had another interesting bit in early 95 in the area near, where was it, Treverno. In the western part of the town, the northern edge of the Muslim area, the Muslim army started attacking, and they were moving north into Livno, if I remember correctly, moving north, taking territory. And we had a couple of the United Kingdom liaison officers, or UKLOs, who were armed guys that sort of did our job, but did it for the Brits. They were following this combat team that was going north up the way, and they reported back. They said it was really odd. We had a party, we were talking about this. He said it was dumb, because they hit this checkpoint, the Serbs are still there, and the discussion between the Serbs and the Muslims went that the Muslims had gone too far and they had to turn around. There was no argument, no fighting. The Muslims turned around and went back to the village, won back, and sort of that was the agreement how far they would go. It was a political game, it seemed, going is that you would give a bit of land, take a bit of land, give a bit of land, take a bit of land, to ensure that the pot kept bubbling and the world's attention continued to be there. Because you remember, this is the same time that Timor is going on. You've got the problem in Ethiopia. Sudan's bubbling. Chad is bubbling. Cyprus is still going on. You know, we were running out of troops. We were running out of people. You know, Canada had five battalions in 94, 95 deployed overseas. And, you know, if you think about it, we only had 11 of them. So we were very, very tired troops. Anyway.
How was the comradeship between the Canadian soldiers and between the other UN soldiers?
Overall, very good, because the moment you arrive, you're friends. because you rely on each other. But you very quickly you take awareness of who's who, and those that you don't trust you deal with carefully. As a team leader, I was very careful with who I would send with who out on missions to, number one, or on patrols to ensure that it got done, and the second, I didn't send people that were dangerous to themselves out because then I'd be picking up bodies. So we were very careful how I created the patrols. You also had issues where you had to be careful with ethnic or religious relationships, because they would tend to side sometimes with the various combatants, and that was sometimes rough. You know, we always joked about the Russians defending the Serbians, as opposed to defending both or protecting both from each other. But you know, it was difficult sometimes. But overall, you trusted each other. The dumb thing for the Canadians, though, was that we had more trouble dealing with our armed troops, because they looked at us as rich unmos as opposed to those poor dog faces with guns. But what they didn't realize was you can have as much money as in the world as you want, but you still need uniforms, communication, and that support from your own country. So I used to have to sometimes go to some of the battalions and deal with either the CEO or the deputy commander just to get the basic necessities as a Canadian that I needed. The dumb thing, the Brits would let us into their, you know, food, for example, the British, because we work so closely with them, we'd get to go into their storerooms in Sarajevo, and the quartermaster would sort of point and say, you can have whatever you need of that, don't have any of that, have some of that. And we'd leave there with foodstuffs galore. We'd make a donation to their little canteen, but we'd have food because you couldn't buy it. In other words, stuff wasn't available. But otherwise, we'd be eating nothing but bread and eggs for, you know, 40 days at a time, and that's not good. But the Canadians, they would be very, very difficult to get them to give us stuff because of the, you know, they didn't understand the conditions we lived under. I remember in Zagreb, they had a freezer in the waiting area for the headquarters troops, and so we'd come in after 60 days, and there'd be a sign on it: "This food is only for CanCon headquarters people." So we weren't allowed to. In fact, in 95, in Canada Day, we weren't even invited to the National Party, the Canada Day Party. We had to complain to get invited there. No, then again, we were all just about to go home, so we were pretty rough at the party. But, you know, you think about that, all that Canadian beer and lobster and steak, and they were not going to include us who had just come out of a year of this crap, and they were there for 6 months at a time. So we were quite incensed at that, but luckily they made the right decision, and we were allowed to go to our National Party. I was really miffed at that. Anyway,
where were you sent on leaves, or could you choose a town?
Leave, you could go almost wherever you wanted, as long as it wasn't in Bosnia, and in Croatia you could stay in Zagreb. They're basically the non-contested areas, but you couldn't holiday in Bosnia. People, you would go down to Dubrovnik. I went to Kirk. I used to go to Ljubljana a lot in Slovenia. Plus, because I was there for a total of 12 months, I had an opportunity of three visits, either home or to bring my family to me somewhere. So I had one trip with my family, my wife and kids, to Greece, and then the other two times I went home. Funny enough, is going home was not a good idea. You come home and your mind is still back in the country because you're so focused on it. So, but it was a long year. And it was long for the family as well.
So overall, did you feel prepared at this mission, and did you feel that the UN had a good impact in Bosnia? And
for working in the UN, the best soldier is a trained soldier. So yes, because Canadians are well trained, I felt good. I felt prepared. The problem is you're stepping into something that there's no real reference point to. So every UN mission is different, every country is different, and every enclave is different. So yes, you think you're prepared, but you're not until you get your feet wet and you get some time in the saddle, per se. Did the UN achieve? No, they didn't, which is why NATO had to come in. So, you know, I think the only mission that's successful in the UN really has been Sierra Leone, which is a true Chapter 7, 35,000 troops doing what they're supposed to do for an army that had disappeared. But this one was a bit different, and there were so many constraints and so many political limitations based on the ethnicity of the region, the Security Council makeup, the indecision or the lack of decision. It was very difficult. Even airstrikes, it would take hours to try and set up an airstrike. Then the decision was to miss the target. You know, good God, how the hell do you support yourself that way? So you had to have double verifications before you could do something. And, you know, we had a month we were trying to find this 76mm gun in the garage that kept sort of shelling the western edge of the enclave. So we never got high enough. And the Americans And the British flyers, they wouldn't share real-time data with us because as military observers, we had mixtures of Russians, etc. You got to remember in 94, just after the Cold War, they were still reluctant on providing capabilities. So I'd have to go and talk sideways to the Brits. They'd tell me sort of stuff, but still keep control. I had one time where I'd asked for an air recce, and they sent an A-10. And the fighters would fly at 10,000 AGL, and the A-10s would fly at 1,000 above ground level, so very low, where the fighters were always very high. And the pilot, he popped around. I was trying to find this gun on the west side of garage, as I said. So he was flying a recce mission for me. And I couldn't talk to him, but what happened was he drew a hand drawing of the top of that hill I was interested in, and he faxed it to the Brits, and the Brits gave it to me. To my undying shame, it's something I left behind when I left the pocket, because it was part of the mission brief, but I sure wish I'd brought a copy of it. But it was very interesting. So it outlined what was the top of the hill, the roads, the bunkers, where the trucks were, but no guns. So that was the end of my airstrike mission. But it was a novel way of a very smart young man to provide data to the requesting force. But the UN, there's so many problems with the UN. You can't say it's an effective force. I'm not a big fan anymore of military UN military missions. They don't seem to work.
Do you feel that this war had an impact on your personal life at all after the war, or?
Yeah, very big. It's it was a long time to spend in a place that you don't have a vested interest, and the risks are cumulative. So yes, it's affected my life. It's affected my family's life. It's a place where I still get some treatment for in order to sort out what's what. It changes how you are as a person. I still have huge problems with smells, for example. I have very difficulty with bad odors. Anyway. Yeah, it's tough.
Do you remember the day that you were being sent back to Canada? How was the feeling? Was it a feeling of relief or?
Oh, yeah, it was great relief. The thing I remember though was coming home and walking through the doors of the Victoria Airport, and there was, for the first time in my life of coming back from somewhere, there was a bunch of people and a great big sign saying, "Welcome home, Major Dad." My kids crying, my wife was crying, and all my friends were there. And they had a big bus, and so we got in the bus and drove me home to my house and had a beer in the bus and had a party in the backyard. And it was the first time ever that I got a welcome home. And I'm forever grateful for that, because out of a year that I thought I was going to die, that sure finished it for me. That was the end of that.
Did you find it hard to reintegrate in civilian life, or?
Yeah, it's hard to your reactions are so much different. How you drive is different, difficult. How you react to people is different. Oh, you're so focused on mission command, mission control, execution of things, doing things, that it's hard to step back to that, to negotiation, discussion, dealing with family normally. It's hard. Took a while. Took a lot of. My wife is a big help, because she tells me when I'm doing things the wrong way, and it took a long time for me to understand what she meant. But it does affect. It still affects me now. I still, if I think about this, I get excited, or it takes me back sometimes, and not normally the nice place. So,
did you still keep in contact with comrades that you had in this war, and did you feel that talking to them about it? Reliefs.
A lot of Canadians went through there. Not a lot of Canadians were military observers, so I know people, but it's now 20 years later, so you know, most of us have gone off our different ways or are finished with the military. But you know, it's the guys who are post the 92 to 95, those I-4, S-4 multinationals, it's not the same thing, and that's the current army. So most of them don't understand what we did anymore in terms of that area. It was a really tough bun fight. You know, everybody thinks of the medic pocket, but the medic pocket went on in a whole bunch of areas, in a whole bunch of ways, in varying degrees. You know, it was a violent, dangerous, tough place. You know, I even remember my first week in Zagreb. I was having a pizza with four of us. We just arrived in country. Across this little narrow alley, a Croatian soldier stood up and shot the guy across from his table. You know, across his table, and we're just sitting there, 20 feet away, watching this execution, basically. So the police came in and took him away, and so we finished eating a pizza, watching him drag a dead body away. That was the welcome to Zagreb, which I thought was a safe city. Yeah. Makes you wonder.
What is one thing that you remember the most from this war theater?
The children.
actually.
The children.
I'm not sure, but we should.
That's it. Yeah.
I think that's enough.
Okay. Okay. No, that's it. I just remember how they're very poor kids. Tough for them. Anything else? Been those 2 hours.
You've answered most of my question.
All right.
Thank you very much for taking part in this and for, you know, reserving history and making history.
Yeah, you're welcome. Thanks.
Thank you very much.